20. The next morning, Martin woke early. He lay in his hammock, listening to nothing. He didn't often hear nothing. He had discovered that living in a medieval town was not much quieter than living in a modern town. Sure, cars make a lot of noise, but so do hooves. And while in a modern house, the road noise is filtered through modern windows, but in the past, it came through either rough, single-glazed glass or a simple hole with wooden shutters. It was quiet now, because it was early, barely dawn. Martin wasn't totally awake, but not totally asleep either. He was in that hazy, semi-conscious state where the dreams of the night before dovetail with the reality of the day ahead. That time where you find yourself thinking, how unfortunate it is that your lower half has been replaced with the body of a crab, and how difficult it'll be to explain to your boss that you couldn't come into work because your pants are now impractical. Martin opened his eyes a crack. A light streamed in around the edges of the window shutters. Philip was in his bed, snoring lightly. The light illuminated the dust that hung in the air, swirling lazily in space. Martin thought about how in a dark room you couldn't see anything, and in a brightly lit room you only saw large things, but in a room with very little light you could see very little things, like dust. As the sun rose, more light came in, and he watched the dust slowly spiraling in random patterns as the shaft of light got larger and brighter. Martin opened his eyes all the way, then immediately squinted. There was clearly a void in the dust next to Philip's bed. It was barely discernible, but dust was flowing around the empty area. The void was irregularly shaped and appeared to be moving. It seemed still toward the floor, but there was a churning quality about the upper part of the void. Martin lifted his head so he was no longer looking at it sideways. He squinted harder, and for just a moment the dust seemed to form the outline of a person leaning over Philip as if he meant to attack. Martin gasped. The form turned suddenly to face Martin, who recoiled in shock and fell out of his hammock. Martin hit the ground and cursed loudly. He looked up and saw that the form was gone, if it ever really had been there. Philip was sitting upright, looking at him.
"What's wrong with you?" Philip asked.
I fell out of bed," Martin sputtered.
"Yes," Philip said, rubbing his eyes. "That's just a symptom, not the root problem, but whatever."
Martin chose not to tell Philip what he'd seen. Bad enough that he'd had a silly half-dream and freaked himself out. No need to make it worse by telling everybody about it. Still, Martin was unusually quiet that morning. Partly because of the strange start his day had, and partly because he was nervous about the trials. Philip did his best to calm Martin's nerves.
"Look, there's no point in freaking out about the trials and ruining your day," Philip said.
"I know," Martin agreed.
"Freak out tomorrow. That's when the trials are. Today's meant to be a day of fun, possibly your last."
Martin didn't think that Philip's best was terribly good. They ate their breakfast, had a conversation about the infinite adaptability of the humble burrito, then ran through a quick checklist of all the things they would need for the trip. It was not a long list. Wizard robes, wizard hats, wizard staff, completed macro, and a positive attitude. Martin asked if he would need his laptop.
"No," Philip said. "Remember, many wizards are from a time before useful portable computers. The trials were designed in such a way that directly accessing the shell is not needed. Besides, you've got your pocket computer. If anything, you've got an advantage. Not that it'll help."
Martin spent a couple of hours going over his macro a few more times. He was certain it would work. He asked Philip to quiz him on the things he'd need to know to pass the trials. Philip asked him some Esperanto vocabulary questions and quizzed him about the finer points of conjuring and flying. But Philip didn't seem terribly concerned. Martin thought this was either encouraging or maddening, though he wasn't sure which. Finally, Philip seemed to get bored and asked,
"Ready to go, Martin?"
Martin said that he was, but he was not sure of it. Philip could sense his hesitation.
"Back up, Martin. 2 days from now, you'll be a fully trained wizard with full shell access. Or you'll be in jail. The point is, you'll know. All the uncertainty will be over."
Martin asked,
"Have I told you that I'm going to miss your little pep talks?"
Philip said,
"No, you haven't,"
Martin said. There's a reason for that. Philip put a reassuring hand on Martin's shoulder.
I have every confidence in you. You'll be fine.
Martin shook his head and started to thank Philip, but Philip interrupted him.
Either way, Transporto Londono Kaveen.
An instant later, they were standing in a pasture. Martin did not react well. Sometimes people will forget what kind of beverage is in their glass. They'll get it in their head that they have a glass of milk, when in fact it's soda. If they take a drink without looking, the pleasant mouthful of pop will, for a moment, taste like the most messed up mouthful of milk in history. Martin had expected city, and instead got a mouthful of pasture. It was a pleasant enough pasture, but Martin had expected a city.
I thought you said we were going to London, Martin said.
Philip smiled.
We're in London. This pasture, those woods, that riverbank over there, especially that riverbank, all of it will be London. If we stand right here, a little under 1,000 years from now, we'll be standing in front of a really good curry stand, I know, and it'd be a good thing because by then we'll be hungry.
Martin looked around. The landscape was dotted with cottages. There were people in the distance tending to sheep, working in their gardens. A relatively busy road, by medieval standards, led off into the woods. More people were headed toward the river than away from it. Martin had never really been one for agriculture, but it was all very picturesque.
Okay, he asked. So why'd you pick this spot? What's your point?
I wanted you to have a moment to prepare yourself for what London is at the moment. You've grown up with pictures of Big Ben and Buckingham Palace. I wanted you to be prepared for the fact that none of that is here. When I showed up, all there was that was recognizable were the beginnings of Westminster and the Thames.
Martin shrugged. Well, at least there's something recognizable.
There was. Back in the pre-Jimmy period of English history. Now, it's been replaced by Camelot and the River Gems.
Martin was confused. Why'd he change the river to Gems?
It's spelled James.
Martin was starting to see why Philip hated Jimmy. Philip held his staff aloft, preparing for flight.
Shall we?
He asked. Martin followed suit, and soon they were flying through the air. Martin was deliberately lagging behind, allowing Philip to lead. They skimmed over the farms and fields, toward the River James. In the distance, beyond the trees, crowded along the far bank of the river, Martin saw what he had to assume was London, or as it was now known, Camelot. From a distance, it looked a lot like Ledchurch. Actually, it looked like 10 Ledchurches packed in together. For Martin's entire life, he had thought of cities as places where there were tall buildings. But aside from one notable exception, there were no tall buildings to be found. The technology simply wasn't there yet. Philip swung in a low, lazy arc around the city. Martin followed. Chaotic patterns of narrow streets and squat, mostly brown buildings spread out below him like a field of wooden blocks. The one exception was a large building next to the river, slightly to the left of the city's central mass. The building was surrounded by a wall that was at least 3 stories tall and seemed to be covered in highly reflective gold. The building itself was not just a castle, it was the castle. It couldn't more obviously be a castle. It bristled with parapets, towers, aeroslits, sky bridges, and buttresses, all covered in the same shiny gold leaf as the outer wall. Philip led Martin to the castle, losing altitude as they went. They barely cleared the wall and landed lightly in a large square just inside the main gate. The road came in through the gate, then made a circle around a large reflecting pool, past the formal entrance to the castle, which looked like the gaudiest casino in Las Vegas had been covered in gold leaf and the greeters replaced with knights in hammered gold armor. Beside the entrance, a golden carriage waited for the royal family. It was hitched to 4 white stallions, presumably because gold stallions weren't available, not that it mattered. Everything within the walls was tinted gold by the reflected light from the castle and the walls. There were several buildings inside the Golden Keep of Camelot, not just the castle.
Maintaining a facility of this size required infrastructure, which added to the size of the facility, and inevitably the whole thing gets out of hand. Martin could see that what from a distance had appeared to be a simple, ridiculously ornate golden castle behind a golden wall was in fact a small golden town surrounding a golden castle inside a golden wall. The guards at the castle entrance were serene and regal, but all around there were workmen, stewards, groomsmen, maids, valets, and craftsmen, all milling about in gold-accented livery, looking at the ground lest they be blinded. The only people looking up at the castle were the tourists, though Martin supposed they were called pilgrims in this time. There were many of them, though, milling about, pointing, squinting, buying surprisingly expensive paintings of themselves in front of the castle.
"Jimmy had a massive tax levied on gold paint," Philip explained.
"Wouldn't it be the king who levies taxes?" Martin asked.
"Ah, you're right! Let me rephrase that. Jimmy had the king tax gold paint. Probably just added it to his daily monarch do list."
"Jimmy really has that kind of power?" Martin asked. Philip shook his head.
"Martin, look at that statue. You tell me who's in charge."
Martin was aware that there was a grand golden statue of some sort in the reflecting pond, but he hadn't looked directly at it for fear of being blinded. He removed his hat, mumbled some Esperanto, and pulled out a pair of sunglasses with round green lenses and metal frames, which made Philip smile. In the center of the reflecting pond stood an intricately detailed statue, approximately 2 stories tall. It featured an older king, King Stephen, it would turn out, handing a spectacularly ornate sword, Excalibur, which Jimmy had made, then claimed he'd found in a lake, Philip explained later, to his son, then prince, now King Arthur, who was, understandably, willing to change his name from Eustace. Standing behind and between the king and his son, with a fatherly, guiding hand on both of their shoulders, was an unmistakable likeness of Jimmy. Not Jimmy as he was, but Jimmy as Jimmy pictured himself, idealized Jimmy. He stood a full head taller than the king and towered over the prince. With his sunglasses, Martin could make out that Jimmy's robe had a Merlin name tag stitched into the right breast, as if he was a mechanic. Jimmy's hat and parts of his head and shoulders were quite severely tarnished and stained. "What's up with Merlin's head?" Martin asked.
Philip shrugged, and with a trace of a smile said, "Ask someone who lives here."
Martin stopped the next person to pass, a porter carrying a crate.
"Pardon me, sir, I'm new to Camelot," Martin said with some effort.
"Can you please tell me why the wizard's head is stained?"
"That's the miracle, innit?"
the man said.
"The miracle?" Martin asked.
"Most every day since the statue was put up, the wizard's head produces a miracle from thin air."
"Really? Every day?"
"Indeed."
"When? Will it be soon?"
"Don't know,"
the porter said.
"The schedule's not very regular."
"Regrettably," Philip added.
"What comes out of the statue?" Martin asked.
"Blood, tears, more gold?"
"Unspeakable filth,"
the porter answered.
After a long, uncomfortable pause, Martin asked, "What kind of filth?"
"Unspeakable filth, like I said."
Another pause.
"Yes, but is it mud? Is it gore?" Martin asked.
The porter thought a moment, then said,
"One could call it muck, I suppose."
"Muck?"
"Yes, unspeakable muck."
"It's excrement, isn't it?"
Yes.
"Feces?"
"Yes."
"Human?"
"Yes, yes, it's unspeakable human muck."
"And it just appears?"
"Yes, it seems to just come from the point of Merlin's hat."
"Then it kind of trickles down," Martin finished.
"No,"
the porter said, shaking his head.
"It don't trickle. It comes down forceful, like it fell a ways."
"Perhaps 30 feet?
Philip offered.
"Could be,"
the porter agreed.
"And nobody knows where it's coming from?"
"We've kind of stopped asking, to be honest. When it first started, a few people went up with ladders to try to get a closer look. They regretted it."
And it's always muck? Martin asked.
Mostly,
the porter said.
There'll also be some mucky paper. On rare occasion, it'll be something different. Word is, one morning last week, it was something that smelled like stew.
Martin looked at Philip, his eyes wide. Philip thanked the porter for the information and sent him on his way. After a moment, Philip said,
Amazing. Eh?
Amazingly immature, Martin replied.
Most acts of protest are. The headlines after the Boston Tea Party didn't refer to the participants as several erudite gentlemen, now did they?
Why doesn't Jimmy stop it?
He can't. It's not like there's a visible doorway to my outhouse hovering over the statue. Stuff just appears there at unpredictable times. He can't come to me directly because he doesn't know I'm the one doing it. He could narrow it down to all the wizards who hate him, but in truth, most wizards hate him, at least a little.
And he knows that?
Knows? He's proud of it. He puts it down to jealousy. All he can do to stop the automatic vandalism is to remove the statue, and he won't do that, ever. It'd be admitting defeat. Instead, he planted the idea that he might have done it himself, as a lesson in humility.
If you dislike him so much, why did you all make him the chairman? Philip spat.
We didn't make him the chairman. He made himself the chairman. His first act as chairman was to appoint himself chairman. There were only three of us at the time, so we didn't think much of it. I thought he was joking, but every wizard who's shown up since then has been introduced to our chairman, Jimmy, and that's that.
After a long silence, Martin said, You have to hand it to him.
I don't hand it to him, but I make sure he gets it all the same.
Philip led Martin into the castle. Martin expected the guards to make some attempt to stop them, but the men in the gold armor stood stock still as the wizards walked past.
They know we're guests of Merlin,
Philip explained. Well, I'm always happy not to get hassled, but still, you'd think they'd have at least shown that they noticed us.
Well, there are guests of Merlin, and there are guests of Merlin,
Philip explained.
If we had arrived with Merlin, I promise you they'd have tripped over each other racing to lick our boots. If a wizard comes to Camelot without Merlin, or indeed unannounced, we're still allowed in because they assume we're here to meet with Merlin, but they kinda take on the same attitude as a high-level executive secretary. You're not as important as their boss, and they control your access to their boss. Therefore, by the transitive property of dominance, they're more important than you.
But they just let us walk in. They didn't even take our staffs. Don't they know how dangerous we could be? Martin asked as they walked through a massive, gold-leaf-encrusted, ornately carved, marble-floored chamber. It would be the main hall of any conventional public building, but here seemed to function as a cloakroom.
No, they don't, Philip said. They think Jimmy is the most powerful wizard in the world, and in a sense, he is, but only because he has influence with the king. They think we stay in line because any wizard who starts any trouble will be immediately exterminated by the mighty Merlin.
Philip leaned in closer and lowered his voice.
If they knew we're just a bunch of dorks, essentially living on the honor system because we know we have a good thing going, well, it really wouldn't change much of anything. But still, we don't want them catching on.
But they'll stop us if we try to go somewhere we're not supposed to, Martin said. Philip stopped walking.
They don't have to, Martin. We can't go anywhere we're not supposed to. You know the second story of my shop?
Where you go to do nothing?
Yes. The reason you've never come up to interrupt the nothing is that you can't. Jimmy, sorry, Merlin, knows the same trick. There are many rooms in this castle that only he, the royal family, and their staff can enter. There are others that only he and the royals can go into, and I'd bet that while there are no rooms he can't enter, there are probably rooms the king himself can't see the inside of without Merlin holding his hand.
Martin looked around. Where are the places we can't go, then?
What do you want, a sign? A velvet rope? No, the guy these people know as Merlin doesn't want to warn people that they can't do things. He wants to remind them that they can't do things. He wants people to try to go through an arch and run into an invisible wall. He hopes they're carrying scalding hot soup when they do it. Merlin never wants the locals to forget that he is Merlin, that magic is real, that he can control it and that they can't. You'll see, everything he does is designed to constantly remind them, including having this room built.
With that, Philip led Martin out of the large, impressive marble and gold leaf anteroom they had been traversing. They walked through a massive arch festooned with innocent-looking cherubs and less innocent-looking nymphs. From a distance, Martin hadn't formed a clear image of what was beyond the arch. He saw more marble flooring, a gold railing, people walking to and fro, and an indistinct wall in the distance. As they walked through the arch, and the full majesty of the room they were entering dawned on Martin, he fell silent. Philip, despite his disgust for Jimmy and all things Jimmy-ish, also went quiet as they entered the famous Great Hall of the Castle Camelot. Martin had gotten used to mentally adding various comments about medieval England to the end of declarative statements. Gwen's an excellent tailor, for someone trained in medieval England. Gwen's a really cute girl, considering she lives in medieval England. I'm spending an alarming amount of time thinking about Gwen, seeing as if I don't concentrate on the trials, I might get kicked out of medieval England. The Great Hall of the Castle Camelot was the first thing, aside from Gwen, he'd seen that would have been equally impressive no matter what time or place he saw it. It was the kind of room that is often described as a shoebox by architects who didn't get the contract to design that kind of room. The hall was at least 100 yards wide and twice as long. Two rows of graceful stone columns ran down the sides of the hall, leaving a large strip of the center of the room open and uninterrupted. The arch that Martin and Philip had used to enter was in the middle of one end of the hall, raised about 3 stories off of the floor. On either side of them, staircases led off to the 4 tiers of walkways that stretched to the far end of the hall. Clearly, these were meant to support spectators. The floor was a vast sea of inlaid marble and other decorative stones. Some of the people milling about clearly had places to go, others clearly did not. The floor seemed relatively empty, but a floor that size would. Martin noted that rather than the reflective gold leaf that decorated most of the castle, the majority of the gold in the hall was a relatively dull gold paint, except for the far end of the hall. That wall was hung with massive tapestries, richly woven with decorative strands of golden thread. Shiny golden stairs led up to the top of a tall, shining gold dais. A massive golden throne sat, flanked on either side by smaller, slightly less impressive golden chairs. Both sides of the room were lined with massive glass windows, larger than Martin would have thought possible in any time, that let in a tremendous amount of light. The ceiling was at least 200 feet above the floor and was a thicket of surprisingly modern-looking metalwork, all painted gold. Martin gaped at it for quite a while before finally asking, "How is this possible?" Philip shook his head.
"Same way everything we do is possible. Magic. It took 6 years from the time King Arthur, who was 12 at the time, by the way, decreed that this place would be built. During that time, Jimmy spent 3 hours a day just creating gold, some to pay for the construction, some to use as construction materials. And most of this is just wood and stone covered with gold leaf. That stuff goes pretty far. When the workmen didn't know how to make the main hall, he taught them about buttresses. When they didn't know how to span the distances, he taught them to make I-beams. When the metal turned out to be too weak, he taught them to make steel. And when the steel took too long to smelt, he just went ahead and made a bunch for them."
Martin was impressed. Good for the craftsmen. They learned a lot.
"Except that he only told them as little as possible, and that magic is what made it all work. Poor buggers killed themselves building the greatest building in the world, and they're convinced that Jimmy deserves all the credit. He warned them that any other buildings made with these methods would be cursed, and just to sell the idea, he destroyed a few churches while they were still under construction. Look, Martin, I don't want to just stand here saying bad things about Jimmy. Sorry, that's not true. I do want to, quite badly, but I won't. Jimmy is smart, he's resourceful, and he can be quite charming. At one time, I considered him a friend. Just remember, the only way anybody ever profits from an encounter with Jimmy is if Jimmy doesn't care enough to bother to prevent it.
Philip gave Martin a quick tour of the main hall, which took over an hour because of the distances involved. The tour ended at the middle of the room. Most of the floor pattern was gigantic rectangular patches of polished gray stone set into the white background. Each large rectangle had long, narrow rectangles running up their longer sides.
The gray parts are banquet tables, Philip explained.
Do you mean they symbolize banquet tables, or that that's where they put banquet tables when they need to? Martin asked.
Neither. I mean that the large gray slabs are tables, and the thinner slabs next to them are benches. Jimmy has a macro on the floor. He says the right trigger phrase, and the slabs rise up and form tables and benches.
This confused Martin. I thought the shell couldn't manipulate anything too large or complex.
They're just slabs of stone. There's nothing complex about them. As for being too large, you're right that you wouldn't be able to take one back to your time with you or anything, but as for levitating, as long as the object is one homogeneous piece, it's possible.
Ah, Martin said. It's because it's all just one thing. If I tried to lift a tree, I'd probably just strip off the bark.
Or rip off a single leaf, which won't impress anybody,
Philip added. Martin continued. But if I lift a boulder, it should work fine.
Yes, kind of, but not really,
Philip clarified.
If the boulder is one solid mass of stone with no impurities to speak of, yeah, you're good. But if there is a vein of a different stone, even just a slightly different type of the same base material, it'll crumble like a dirt clod.
So how did he get such large chunks of pure stone?
Same way most of us learn about sex. Trial and error. He teleported out to the quarry every time they'd chisel a slab off the side of the mountain and he'd try to lift it. If it hung together, it became a table. If it shattered, it got used for smaller bits.
Martin smiled and shrugged. Phil, you say that like it's a big waste of time, but I bet the workmen who were saved the trouble of breaking up the big slabs of granite with chisels didn't mind. Philip's eyes widened. He set his index finger in making an important point mode. He got so far as to say,
But it's all...
before he was interrupted.
Ooh, Jimmy said from between Martin and Philip. He is a perceptive one, isn't he, Philip?
Both Martin and Philip jumped. Neither of them had thought that anybody, let alone Jimmy, was anywhere near them. They both turned quickly and were perplexed to find that they were right. Nobody was within 30 feet of them. Jimmy's voice laughed. It was a small laugh, mostly sympathetic, but with an undercurrent of smugness.
I'm over here, gentlemen,
the voice said, still from an empty spot between them. They continued to look around them, confused. After a moment, Jimmy spoke again.
Oh, damn, sorry about that.
There was a pause, then faintly, from a great distance behind them, they heard,
I'm over here.
They turned and saw Jimmy standing in front of the dais, hundreds of feet from where they stood. He was only recognizable for his green and gold robes and the small dot of light emanating from the plasma ball at the top of his staff. Jimmy spread his arms wide and said something else, but from that distance it was hard to make out.
I'm sorry, we can't hear you, Merlin. You're too far away,
Philip yelled. He did not look sorry. Everyone in the entire hall was now looking at the three of them, the two wizards standing out in the open vastness of the hall, and the most famous wizard in the world standing at the far end, apparently struggling to be heard. If Merlin was irritated or worried, he didn't let on. He simply took a single step forward. He stepped forward slowly, like he was absent-mindedly drifting around the room while thinking about something else. His back foot lifted from the ground before his forward foot touched down, and in the intervening second, he covered the entire distance between himself and the other wizards. He didn't fly so much as he floated with great speed. When his forward foot did touch down, there was no sense of any unusual weight or momentum. He simply had taken a single step forward and had arrived where he was going. It was a powerful demonstration of the casual, effortless use of tremendous power. Martin remembered what Philip had said about Jimmy's need to constantly remind people what he could do.
"I said, welcome to Camelot, Martin."
Jimmy smiled and extended a hand, which Martin shook. It was a good, solid handshake and a natural, toothy smile.
"Philip is giving you the tour, I see. What do you think?"
"It's amazing," Martin said.
Jimmy held the handshake and the smile slightly longer than expected. After a moment, he said,
"But?"
He seemed amused, not irritated. If anything, his smile brightened. Martin laughed nervously.
"It's all a bit
vulgar," Philip offered. "Hideous, repugnant."
"Much,"
Martin said. Jimmy smiled at both Philip and Martin. Martin smiled back. Finally, the handshake ended, punctuated by a firm slap on Martin's back.
"You're not wrong, Martin. Walk with me."
Jimmy turned and started moving toward the center of the hall. To Martin's relief, he didn't traverse the entire distance in one step as before, making it difficult to keep up. To Philip's disgust, he instead simply levitated several inches above the ground and floated forward at a walking pace, robes flapping behind him as if he were standing on the shore of a windswept lake. The marble floor seemed to distort beneath him and smooth out behind him as he moved, like the wake behind a boat. Martin walked beside him, listening. Philip followed behind, glowering.
"You see, Martin, despite what some people may believe, I'm not in charge here. I serve at the pleasure of the king,"
Jimmy said, looking down at Martin from his elevated height.
"King Eustace," Philip said.
"Indeed, although he prefers to be called Arthur."
"At your suggestion," Philip added.
"Exactly. As Philip says, I make suggestions, but the king makes the decisions. I just try to help. I'm a consultant. They wanted a castle, I suggested a location. They wanted it to be the greatest castle of all time. I showed them how it could be done. They wanted it covered in gold. I made that happen. They wanted their names to be remembered in myth and legend. Can you think of a better way to accomplish that than to use the Arthurian myth?"
"Use?" Philip spat. "You mean hijack?"
Jimmy stopped, still hovering, and pivoted as if he were standing on a turntable to face Philip. Martin would have expected him to look irritated, but he seemed delighted.
"Yes! Philip's right, Martin. Hijack is a good description of what we did to the Arthurian legend. It's an ugly word, but really, use isn't much better. Before you think too ill of me, Martin, let me show you something."
He pivoted again to face the spot they'd been walking towards. The exact center of the hall was marked by a massive inlaid medallion. A perfect circle of polished granite 20 feet wide was set into the floor. The circle was decorated with intricate scrollwork and inlaid floral motifs. Like moons orbiting a planet, 13 granite circles, 2 feet across, were spaced evenly around the circumference of the medallion. Everyone in the hall had watched the wizard since the moment Jimmy joined them, but Martin was suddenly far more aware of it. All conversation had stopped. The world was holding its breath. Jimmy took a deep breath, and for a moment, Martin thought of him as Merlin. Merlin said,
"Ronde the tablo supraniero,"
and tapped the circle closest to their feet with his staff. Blue tendrils of lightning, similar to those in his novelty store plasma ball, shot from the tip of his staff and filled the 2-foot circle of granite set into the floor. The sparks radiated to the edge of the circle, tracing its outline on the floor. The light continued along the edges of the 13 smaller circles, then leapt to the medallion in the center until all of the circles were outlined in blue light. A sound filled the air, like a 2-ton slab of stone sliding against another 2-ton slab of stone, recorded, amplified, and played through a speaker carved from a 2-ton slab of stone.
Slowly, all of the circles began to rise. As they rose, the circles were revealed to be the tops of pedestals, their sides bowing inward gracefully toward the middle, like a stylized hourglass. The 13 smaller columns stopped rising and were about a foot and a half tall. The central medallion stood taller than the other columns and was similarly bowed inward, but rather than flaring back outward, simply stopped at its narrowest point. The hall was steeped in reverent silence. So it was particularly grating when Philip said,
"Nice card table you've got there."
Jimmy ignored him. As the people in the hall got back to their business, Jimmy turned to Martin.
"What do you think?"
Martin walked forward and put his hands on the table.
"It's the round table."
"It's a round table," Philip corrected him. "It's not the real round table."
"It's a real round table," Jimmy corrected Philip. "The other round table, the one Philip's referring to, never existed. So I ask you, Martin, isn't this the real round table?"
"But it's not the authentic round table," Philip said.
"It is authentic," Jimmy said. "It's what's really here. The fact that reality doesn't match what you want or expect isn't reality's fault. Besides, authenticity is overrated. When you were a kid playing in your backyard, who'd you pretend to be? Han Solo piloting the Millennium Falcon, or Buzz Aldrin going to the bathroom in his astronaut pants?"
Martin, still running his hands over the table's polished surface, said,
"But the table's just furniture. The king and the knights were the point, and they're different."
"I bet their names sound familiar, though," Philip said.
"I only suggested changing three of their names. Lancelot, Galahad, and Gawain. And to be fair, Gawain's original name was Dwayne, so that was a lateral move. Philip's got a valid point, Martin. I'm not proud of everything I've done. I bent reality to fit a work of fiction just to make the royal family happy. I had good reasons, though. A happy king doesn't start wars out of boredom. I've given them this castle because a wealthy king doesn't start wars out of greed. I made them legends because a living legend doesn't kill out of jealousy."
"He gives them what they want, and in return they do exactly what he tells them," Philip said. "Because if they ever stop, he might stop too."
"I'm not forcing anybody to do anything. And I put it to you, Martin, whom have I hurt?"
"You may not tell them that they have to do what you say or else," Philip said, staring directly at Jimmy. "But when was the last time they didn't do what you told them to?"
Jimmy, who would face Martin through the entire conversation and didn't change that now, answered,
"I'm fortunate that the king seems to hold me and my advice in high esteem."
"Yes,"
Philip said.
"The level of the esteem in which you are held is amply demonstrated by that statue out front."
Although neither man spoke for the next 5 seconds, they were the most eventful of the entire day, as the facial expression equivalent of a chess match played out, with Martin as the spectator. At the mention of the statue, Jimmy, for the first time, seemed genuinely irritated. For an instant, Philip looked quite pleased with himself. Jimmy seemed unsure if this was because he had gotten in a good insult, or if Philip knew something about the continued vandalism of his likeness.
"Was it a confession?" he seemed to wonder. "Or is he just laughing because someone else has gotten one over on me?"
Jimmy gave Philip a suspicious, questioning look. Philip doubled down on the smugness, with a side order of slightly confused innocence, as if to say,
"What are you looking at me like that for? I know nothing about how your statue is regularly anointed with feces."
This did nothing to answer Jimmy's unspoken questions, so he did what he always did when unsure of himself. He feigned confidence. He smirked and almost imperceptibly nodded his head. It was very convincing. For a moment, Martin thought Philip was caught. Philip clearly knew that Jimmy was bluffing, and he chose to stand pat with the smug, confused innocence, now with more smug. This, Martin saw, was a masterstroke. To laugh, smile, or even nod would be an admission of guilt. To blanch, flinch, or look away would be just as big an admission.
To continue with no change in expression would have told Jimmy that he was trying not to betray any information, which would have told Jimmy everything he wanted to know. To remain innocently confused, but get slightly smugger, told Jimmy, "You think you know something. I know what you think you know. I know if you're right or not, and I'm never, ever going to tell you."
"Well," Jimmy said, turning back to Martin, "I must get back to my business. It was good to see you again, Martin."
Jimmy tapped the stool closest to him, and the round table and stools silently sunk back into the floor.
"Goodbye, Jimmy," Philip said.
"Goodbye, Martin," Jimmy said. "I'll see you tonight."
Jimmy turned, and in a single graceful step was at the golden dais at the far end of the hall. In another step, he was at the top of the dais, next to the throne. He paused there, turned, and looked at Philip as he stroked the back of the throne of England. Then he glided around a corner and disappeared into a hole between the tapestries Martin had not noticed before. They watched him leave. Then Philip said,
"It may surprise you to know this, Marty, but I really do hate him."
"He makes some valid points," Martin said.
"That's a big part of why I hate him.
If he were wrong about everything, I could just dismiss him as a moron.
But he's not. He's smart, probably smarter than I am. So I have to take him seriously."